This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Mark Pinsky has been writing about Florida for more than 25 years. Pinsky, who covered religion with the Orlando Sentinel for a large part of that stint, was also a crime reporter, and he's also written several non-fiction works, including an examination of the cold case murder of Nancy Morgan. Pinsky is leaving the Sunshine State and moving to North Carolina. I caught up with him to talk about religion, politics, and the next chapter of his writing career. Mark Pinsky, it's very nice to speak to you again. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So this is a departure from Florida, but you're not leaving the world of journalism altogether, right?
That's correct. I'll be writing, continue to write. It's what motivates me in a professional sense and what motivates me in a political sense as well. So I'll continue to be freelancing as well as working on books.
What do you think you're going to miss about the environment, I guess the journalism environment or the range of things you can write about as a resident of Florida once you leave?
I think being immersed in the world of evangelical Christianity. I mean, I'll certainly miss my former colleagues and friends from the Orlando Sentinel. But I think coming here 26 years ago, my eyes were kind of open to a world I knew nothing about. And I became immersed in it, and I'll miss it, actually, when I'm gone.
And just sort of reflecting on what you've covered in the world of evangelical Christianity for a start, how much has that changed in Florida, at least, and how important is Florida now as a home for many of these mega churches?
I think one of the first set of stories that I did when I came here 26 years ago was the migration of major evangelical institutions to Central Florida, beginning with Campus Crusade for Christ, but ministries involving Africa, involving Latin America. That was the beginning. And I think what I liked about it was that on the one hand, I was approaching these institutions as well as the mega churches in the area, particularly First Baptist of Orlando and Northland. I was reporting on them on two levels. On one level, I was interviewing the leaders on the phone or in person with the mediation of a reporter's notebook. But at the same time, I was meeting grassroots evangelicals, suburban evangelicals in my neighborhood, PTA, public schools, scouts, rec athletics with my kids as our kids grew up. And I didn't have the reporter's notebook. I just met people and got to know them, not in a transactional way. With my reporting, I wanted to get some information, and the people I was interviewing wanted to convey a certain amount of information, but my daily life was informing my reporting.
Do you feel like the evangelical church has the same kind of influence on politics now that it did a quarter of a century ago?
Oh, I think it's even greater. Central Florida is a good example, particularly of suburban Sunbelt evangelicalism. And in the time that I was here, their influence both within the state and within the nation gradually grew until it became a really potent segment of the political equation. I first began writing about Southern politics, if you can believe it, in 1972 for a national audience, Senate races. And so I've been coming in and out of Southern politics in a secular sense since 1972. But in the last 25, 26 years, I've watched and reported on the political rise and the influence of particularly white evangelical Sunbelt suburban evangelicals.
And one name that sticks out, particularly over the last 4 years at least, is Paula White, who was kind of anointed the White House spiritual advisor. And you had been seeking an interview with her for quite some time. Just tell us a little bit of the backstory of that and how you finally kind of got to sit down and talk with her.
Well, the backstory was I wanted to do a piece about her before she was appointed. These were several years before she was appointed to the position that she had in the White House. And I was very interested, and I kept requesting an interview, and I never got one, not in a formal sense. Finally, I just went to church, which is what I learned to do with other religious leaders, just got in the reception line after the church, after the service was over. And she was very polite, very friendly. She said she would be happy to set up an interview, and then it never happened. Her PR firm never let that happen. So as a journalist, you can't let someone veto themselves as a subject. So I continued to write about her, and I would hear back from time to time that she liked or didn't like, but still no interview. And then I would say 3 years ago, there was a reception held by Orlando Magazine for people who were in their 50 most powerful, influential issue. And the subjects were invited to a kind of an open-air cocktail party at the Mall Millennium. And when I went there with my wife, I noticed that she showed up, and I was chatting with another of my evangelical friends, the Reverend Joel Hunter, and I thought, here's an opportunity. So I asked Joel to come over, and I introduced Joel to Paula, and she was very friendly. She said she's glad to meet me. She read my stuff, and we should get together for an interview, and then there was never any interview. So she was elusive over the years, but that didn't keep me from, I think, probably writing more about her than any other secular journalist in the country.
It's kind of interesting, too, I mean, reflecting on that, somebody having a very kind of central role in some ways as a spiritual advisor, but at the same time, it's really, a lot of it's just about getting votes, right? And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what we saw in the most recent election, particularly in the state of Florida, which went fairly comprehensively for President Trump, to the disappointment of a lot of Democrats in the state of Florida. How much of a role do you think the church or evangelical churches and their congregations played in that election?
I think white evangelicals played a critical role in this election, as they have in recent elections in Florida. I think also the shift in the Latino vote was also critical in Trump's margin of probably more than 300,000 votes in Florida. But I don't think any Republican can win without the support of white evangelicals. And in the last election, they supported President Trump by around 80%, the last figures that I saw. I've always felt that there was a small percentage of white evangelicals who were more moderate on issues like climate change and various issues, not abortion, who, if the Democrats were smart, they would try to peel off. I thought more of that would happen, but it didn't happen this time. Even so, with 80% of white evangelicals supporting Trump, that still meant that fully 20% supported Biden, and the last election supported Hillary, who came with a lot of baggage with her, whereas Biden is a religious Catholic and certainly lives a different kind of personal life than President Trump has, which apparently is not – the character issue apparently is not so critical for white evangelicals when it comes to politics.
Well, Mark, I've spoken to you numerous times on Intersection over the years, and a few years ago I talked to you about a book that you'd written called Meta on the Mountain. It's about a cold case murder, and you've written about a few true crime mysteries. Do you have some more on the back burner that you're hoping to dig into in the next phase of your career?
I do. I have a book coming out next spring, another nonfiction crime book, another gruesome tale, unfortunately, but that's what comes to me. It involves a gifted young man who was at Vanderbilt, and after his sophomore year, he began slowly drifting into madness, as it turned out. And he ended up murdering his wealthy parents in Montgomery, Alabama, with an axe handle, which for some people brought up echoes of the infamous Lizzie Borden case early in America's tradition. So it's called Drifting into Darkness, and it like a Meta on the Mountain, it involves me trying to solve the case, in this case, assisting police in both this case and another murder that was somehow attached. So it's odd. I go back and forth between murder and religion. when I first was moved from the crime beat to the religion beat, people asked me what the difference was. I said, well, jokingly, I was meeting a better class of felon in my new beat.
I mean, they're both rich seams for content, right? I mean, there's a wealth of stories in both. I kind of wonder, though, do you feel like enough attention is being paid to religion. I mean, it seems to have fallen by the wayside a little bit as a beat that, you know, newspapers focus on, and that might be partly just because of the hollowing out a little bit of the newspaper industry and the fact that they have fewer reporters to devote to some of these beats.
That's correct. As the regional newspaper industry has imploded, religion was one of the first beats to go or to be combined into other portfolios. And I think there might have been some weariness about it. I think people might have gotten tired, particularly about reading what may have read like the same story over and over again. I feel like there's always something new and interesting about religion, but the public's taste for it seems to have declined somewhat. And I don't know, it's a chicken and egg. Is it declining because there are fewer religion reporters digging up good stories, or are there fewer religion reporters because people are just tired of the subject and have heard enough or read enough of the subject?
I'm curious too, your thoughts, Mark, on the influence of the pandemic on the church. I mean, a lot of these places that you've reported on, a lot of those places would have had to sort of put things on hold for the last 12 months, although, of course, we read about some that didn't, and defiance of some of the kind of social distancing regulations. But do you feel like the pandemic may have some kind of lasting influence on people's willingness to gather at places of worship in person, at least? Or do you see some kind of long-term influence, whether it's driving more people to worship online?
I think being able to worship online has opened many doors for many people of faith. Institutionally, I think COVID has been crushing almost every house of worship that has had to stop in-person services. Others have reached out. They've been technically innovative. I know City of Destiny, Paula White's church, has been very much involved in food distribution. The problem is that nationally, even before COVID, there's been a longstanding decline in institutional affiliation with organized religion. And that has no group has escaped that, even evangelicals and Pentecostals. And I'm afraid that the period, this interregnum of not a year or more of not being able to worship in person, is going to accelerate that trend. Now, for those people for whom in-person worship is fulfilling and supporting, I think when we are over this, they'll recover and they'll find a place. But what I see is, across the board, denominationally, faith-wise, I see consolidation of houses of worship that are no longer financially viable. And so the fewer people who care will have a place, and it will be very important to them. But in the aggregate, I think the trend line is negative. And the pollsters call these people, particularly millennials, with the first sort of canary in the coal mine, they were called the nones, which is to say N-O-N-E, that they no longer affiliated with organized religion, but they also identified themselves as spiritual people. And no one has been able to figure out how to make that trend work to preserve organized religion in America.
I just wanted to go back to a point you made earlier about Paula White's church. Had a conversation not too long ago with Steve McKinnon from St. Luke's United Methodist Church about the role that church has had over the last 12 months in helping out people in the performing arts community with a food drive that happens each week. And it seems to me like you've got a kind of a dichotomy where, maybe churches are suffering because their congregations can't get together, and therefore that's not great for them financially or just holistically. But at the same time, people are leaning more on nonprofits, including churches, because there's such a great need. And it seems like that sort of is in some ways maybe kind of refocusing what churches are about or some of their mission over the last 12 months.
It emphasizes what's historically known in America as the social gospel. And that is the religious community, mainly the church in this country, reaches out when there's crisis and fulfills a role. And they, from that action, they will often derive members or people who come who had no connection with the church other than they helped me when I was in trouble. Maybe I'll give them a chance now that it's possible. On the other hand, this increasingly sophisticated technical outreach means, I think, more and more people will be able to participate, if not in person, if it's raining, if it's cold, if they don't like to drive at night. my own congregation, the Congregation of Reformed Judaism, has had more people, in a sense, attending their Friday night services, for example, under COVID, than we ever had before COVID. And I think this opens another door for self-preservation, and also to keep people connected who otherwise would have to turn on the TV, you know, if their congregation or their denomination paid for services. Now, with online streaming, it opens the door for many people who might have been isolated and who couldn't participate in person.
Well, Mark Pinsky, pleasure as always to talk to you, and best of luck for the upcoming book and the move.
Thank you very much, and I'm hoping to be back in town maybe next January, February, or March, and maybe we can chat again. I'll be flogging books when I come back.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find archived episodes of Intersection online at wmfe.org/intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter over at Matthew_Petty. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.